Blog Talk Radio.
January 27th, 2014, and this is Foxology Today. Happy Monday, everybody. I am Silver Ray Fox, your host. How's your day? Well, I hope you are already whistling a happy tune. I hope you got out of the bed with some happy thoughts today. That's what I'm really hoping. I hope you are determined to make this a happy day. You know, I've learned that if you focus on your problems, they just seem to get worse. Yes, they do. And if you wallow in discouragement, you will just feel worse. I don't like that very much. If you let disappointment over things get the best of you, well, guess what? It will be worse. So determine within yourself to fight it. That's what we have to do when these things try to steal the happy out of our lives and out of our day. And contrary to many popular beliefs, you can see things differently. And when you do, you can do differently, be different, and live differently. Yes, 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 you can. Well, today I'll be talking about just that, winning our own personal battles within, particularly in the area of something very serious, in the area of domestic violence. Last week, I began a series on domestic violence, The Will to Win. And today, we will discuss in part two of this series, The Batterer's Battle Within, with my special guest, Sherry Kendall. She is the CEO of AIDS to Victims of Domestic Violence here in Houston. And she has an extensive history in her field overall and in the help, healing, and support of both men and women abusers. And she has her own personal story of domestic violence, which she'll also share with us today as well. Welcome, Sherry.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. I'm excited to have you. How's your day going so far?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's off to a great start. I know we've got some wintry weather coming our way, but today's a beautiful day.
Yeah, for sure it is. A little bit cloudy, but we know that can change in an instant here in Texas.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. Well, listen, I want to get this conversation started at first talking about you and your history. You have such a huge, luminous history in this field. And let's talk about how you began in the field, work your way up to what you're doing now, and then let's hear about your own personal story.
Okay, I would be happy to do that. You know, I came into this work, as a lot of people do, through personal experience. I think that's a very natural phenomenon in this work, and really in any kind of social justice work. We are drawn to the things that have impacted us in a personal way. When I was very, very young, I entered into a relationship, and I married someone who I soon learned had an explosive temper and was extremely abusive. But, of course, as it often happens, I didn't see those signs early. They're typically hidden. It's not the sort of thing that you put out there during that courting phase. So I never saw that volatility in public, but once I married, it really set in pretty quickly. Over the course of about 4 years, I was certainly verbally and emotionally abused, but I nearly lost my life twice, once through strangulation and once through his finger being on the trigger of a double-barreled shotgun. And it took me a long time to give up hope of that changing. You know, that certainly is the norm as well. Battered women stay in an abusive relationship for a lot of reasons, but I think love and hope of change is certainly a big, big part of that. And you know, many promises and apologies later, I did finally decide to divorce and leave that relationship, just knowing it was never going to change. Several months later, I not only left the town where we lived, but I moved to England for several years. And it was a wonderful respite from that, not having to worry about things. But when I returned to the U.S., I was looking for volunteer work at that time, and quite naturally I was drawn to the field of domestic violence, which was a pretty new field back then. I began as a crisis line worker for a brand new shelter that was opening up in Castle Rock, Colorado, and then after a couple years moved to Texas, and I started out volunteering as a shelter. And one thing I've seen in the field through the years is that it used to be very much a grassroots movement. Like myself, I was in it for a personal draw initially. Through the years, it's become more professionalized, but there are still a lot of us who are in here having started out as volunteers. And so I've worked in Colorado, Oklahoma, Texas, and launched into this work, I guess, in 1985. So about 27 years, I devoted my professional life to working with both male and female abusers. And it was just a little over a year ago that I became the CEO of Aid to Victims of Domestic Abuse.
Sherry, how long did it take you to feel a true sense of being healed in your own self, your being, and in your life? I think it's wonderful and pretty commendable that you decided to, and as you said, that's sometimes the backstory of a lot of people who have gotten into the field. But I would have to think, when you go through that, the scars, it's always been said that there's scars that are on the outside, but there are even deeper scars within. And so how long did it take you, and what process did you carry yourself through, if you would share that with us? Not just where you got support and where you got mentoring, but tell us about what you were thinking and dealing with, trying to do your own self-help and healing too.
I'd be happy to talk about that. And I don't know that my path is as typical as others might be. I did have that benefit of being able to flee to another continent. And so I think that was my initial response, was let me just get away from this to where I feel safe. And so I really had several years of not dealing with it much. But it was very interesting. I thought that it was not a big issue. And then when I came back, and I was living in Texas, not far from my abuser. I later, not too long into it, found out. It was interesting. I'd gone about 4 years without nightmares, and all of a sudden, the bad dreams started showing up. And I entirely attribute that to being in closer proximity and feeling more vulnerable again, and it brought up all those feelings. Now, I will say that I never, through those years, lived in a house where I didn't have a plan on how to get out safely, even though I was no longer with that abuser. It's just one of those things that a survivor does, is you begin in future relationships to look for ways that you need to take care of yourself. But early on, certainly, I did not have support from a domestic violence organization, and I certainly encourage people to reach out in that way. I did, however, though, have the support of family and friends, who I eventually told what happened. And when those nightmares kicked in, I got into counseling, and that's when I found out what it was all about. And also at that point, around that time, I began working and volunteering too. So I think giving back, I think we do deal with our issues sometimes by helping others through them, but I do encourage people to consider, whether it's individual counseling, group counseling, get some support from someone who really does understand domestic violence. And they also can do safety planning and that sort of thing, which is, I think, very, very important. But there are so many, I know we'll come back and talk about this later, but there are so many wonderful resources out there now that didn't exist back in the day that I was first dealing with this. You know, I'm not even sure that I knew it was illegal when it was going on. You know, now we have the laws that are enforced around domestic violence and just tremendous community support to help victims sever those ties that bind them to the abuser.
Yes, yes, of course, and that's such good news. Did you have any issues with your own sense of independence and self-esteem that you had to restore within your own thinking? Or did all of this come, you know, was it gradual for you as you went through the process of offering assistance and all of that? Was there just a kind of a change just taking place in you naturally about how you saw things and how you thought?
Well, I want to acknowledge up front that not all abusers use the same tactics. And so for many, many, and probably the norm for most abusers, is that they do try to tear down the self-esteem of their victim. My abuser had other tactics, and tearing down my self-esteem was not one of them. I was fortunate that during the time that I was in that four-year abusive relationship, I was also in school, getting an education, working. I never gave up a need for independence. So I was very, very fortunate in that sense. So I was never financially dependent upon my abuser, nor did we have children together. That's another very, very strong tie that binds the victim to the abuser. So once I left that relationship, I was also very, very blessed to be around a lot of men throughout my life that have been very, very good men. They've not been abusive. And I think that has helped in that healing process as well. And I've worked with thousands of abusers. I do see people as whole human beings. They're much more than just being an abuser, so I believe in people's ability to change. But I never had my world kind of colored in or tainted in such a way that I look at men as being abusers. I just happen to live with an abuser.
Yes, thank you for those insights. Your expertise is in the area of battering intervention. And I specifically want us to address a lot of those particular points. I, like you, believe people can change, and I know they can if they really want to. And so as we speak today, I want us to offer as much education, enlightenment, and encouragement for those who really want to make a difference. I really believe that there is such a crisis in families, and this is one of the major issues. And as you said, it stays hidden. You know, issues remain hidden. And if families are to heal, which impacts our society, our community and society, then we have to be brave enough as individuals, even as hard and as harsh as some of our issues are, we have to brave ourselves through them because they're too detrimental to self and the people around us, and not just our immediate families, but our extended families and friends as well. So I want you to talk to us, first of all, about the batterer issue, what you see that they suffer from most themselves, and as you explain it, where do they go from there when they find that maybe they have issues of their own, cycles of abuse, maybe alcoholism, maybe drugs, I'm not sure. But tell us what to do in those situations as friends, as family, because I think you and I had the conversation the other day about coming out as an abuser can potentially put the abuser at risk as well, at least in their own thinking, if they don't strategize it correctly. And when we talked about it, you know, we talked about if a parent would know, or a brother, or some other family member who had real problems with it enough that they wanted to do something serious about it. So let's talk about a plan. Let's talk about how they think, what to do, and I'll just let you get started, and I'll ask questions as we go.
Sounds good. And, yes, please do jump in at any time, because that's a tall order. There's an awful lot there to talk about.
Yes,
but maybe a good starting point is, you know, what are some of the underlying causes, and what have the batters gone through that has perhaps led them down that path? What I have found, and I want to talk also about the difference I see between male abusers and women who are also using abusive behavior, because we do work with both in our program. But the vast majority that I've worked with through the years have been men. And certainly the commonality that I see is the vast majority of them batter because initially it's a learned behavior. It's something that most of them saw in childhood. Either they were watching their mom get beat up, they may have been directly abused themselves, but that childhood experience for men is a tremendous predictor of being an adult abuser. So that's something that we really want to be mindful of when we think about what are we allowing our children to experience. Because if I'm in a relationship and my child is seeing me be abused, I'm putting them at tremendous risk for repeating that behavior as an adult. So that childhood experience is enormous. We also certainly need to think about how are men socialized, and how are boys socialized different than girls. What are all those messages that they're given? You know, boys don't cry. If you get into a fight with somebody, you know, you need to walk away with them looking worse than you, and that it's not manly to walk away from a fight. There's all these messages that are given to young boys that develop that framework for their belief system as adults. Certainly rigid gender expectations and roles. You know, we all know relationships in which the men are expected to do this and the women are expected to do that. And there's not a lot of room for individuality and choice about how we write our own job descriptions in our relationships. So those rigid gender expectations, I think, are a key part of it. I think we gotta look at society a little bit. I think there's a lot of blame to be placed at the feet of society when you look at the visual images we get. How are women depicted? How are men depicted? What are the messages around what a strong man is? And certainly, violence being an expression of male anger. I mean, that's very accepted in the society, and that's certainly something we need to change. But, you know, the cornerstone of all of it is choice. It's absolutely choice, because, you know, all day long we could say, well, he does it because of this, he does it because of that. But at the end of the day, he's making a choice whether or not to abuse or not to abuse. But would you agree with that?
The argument that I would hear back from that is that it's such an emotional response to whatever triggers there are, that there's hardly time to reel yourself back in. Well, I know that that's not true. I know within a split second you can say, no, that's not the way to handle it. But what is your response to that? Because many people really believe there's no controlling anger in the sense of true control.
I love the question. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. Quite often, and certainly historically, when someone has been a domestic violence abuser, they've been ordered into something called anger management, with this assumption that they don't know how to control their anger. They don't have the skills to control their anger. And I will tell you, nine out of ten men that I work with have perfectly good anger management skills. If they're furious with their boss, they're not going to hit him. If they're furious with the highway patrol officer that pulled him over, not going to slap him around, right? So it's based on a belief system that has a set of rules that say, okay, in this instance, I have the right to have power and control over somebody. In this instance, I don't. And then, of course, consequences come in a lot. You know, when you look at the fact that when it comes to domestic violence, the vast majority of the fatalities certainly happen in the home. They happen behind closed doors. Abusers are not dummies. They know how and when and where to pick their episodes of violence, and they do it strategically oftentimes. So it's not a matter of losing control. In fact, if anything, if you want to talk about control, I would say that it typically escalates in moments in which they feel as though they are losing control. So anger, and that inappropriate expression of anger, is really used to get control back.
Mm.
So yeah, it's a choice.
Is it always a situation where the batterer is the one who needs the anger management based on what you have said? And here's what I'm getting at. During some training that I had, there were four gentlemen there who were in the prevention program. And I was so anxious for the Q&A because I had one question that was just, oh, so on my mind that I wanted to ask. And I did ask them, are you truly feeling, because the general conversation was implying that there was such provocation on the woman's part. And I said, is it true? Are you serious? Are you really saying that these episodes are based on your wife or your partner's provoking you to beat them up? I said, tell me the truth, please. Is it them or is it really you? And I asked the question just like that because I couldn't go with that. And all of them, all four of them, very honestly, and I was so pleased because there was an audience, a room full of us taking this training, and they said, it's me. It's really me. And so what can we, I want you to speak both to the other side of it as far as I'm sure there are situations where they feel provoked. You know, we say this thing, don't start nothing, won't be nothing, and I'm kind of in that agreement. Don't start a fight, it won't be a fight. But let's talk about what you could tell us about the interaction and controlling that on both sides.
Well, I think there are a lot of pieces to that. The first thing I would say to it, though, is that provocation is no excuse for abuse. Certainly, any of us can be in a relationship in which our partner, in which we feel provoked by our partner, and even that is a complex issue because my partner may be doing something that just about anybody would be absolutely incensed by, but I still get to choose what my response is to it. The emotion, you could even argue that how I think about it impacts how I feel about it, but let's just say that I can't control my emotion, so my emotion maybe is anger. I still get to choose what my action is. So provocation, again, is no excuse. I think we also need to look at each individual batterer and look at when and why do they feel provoked. Is it because they've come home and their partner's in bed with their best friend? Or is it because they've come home and dinner isn't on the table yet? And by golly, it was supposed to have been on the table 5 minutes ago. So provocation is a tricky thing. Again, it's that internal, it is an internal response, but a lot of folks certainly do use it as an excuse.
That's very good. Well, I know there's a lot more attention in recent years given to the fact that it's not just men who are the abusers. There are a lot of women now, which, you know, it's one of those things that was kind of overlooked and maybe not thought of in the same manner. Tell us about women as abusers, what differences, if there are any that you see, and if they need the same kind of help and treatment as male abusers?
Great question. I think to some extent we have a misperception in society about there being more women abusers than there used to be. If you look at the national statistics that were given by the government, I believe it's the Bureau of Statistics, if you look at the graphs from the 1970s to now, you'll actually see that women killing their male partners is at a much lower rate now than it was back then. Women have actually made more inroads into reducing their violence than men have in their violence against women. So I think it's, I do think it's a misperception, and I think it's largely based on what happens in the media. If a man, in the Houston community anyway, my perception is when a man kills a woman, it gets 1 or 2 inches of text in the newspaper. When a woman kills a man, it's a much bigger deal. And we all know, some of the stories that they just go on for months and months and months. And I think that's because society, to a great extent, has accepted that behavior for men. And they're still a little bit surprised about it with women. So it's really not it's not statistically accurate that women's violence has gotten worse towards men, certainly not with regards to fatalities.
Mm-hmm.
Having said all that, and anybody who's getting killed by their partner, it's entirely avoidable and unacceptable. If I could, though, let's talk about the statistics for just a second before I let that go, because men based on statistics that were given by the government, men are killing their female partners about twice the rate that women are killing their male partners. So that's still a lot of people. I mean, there's still a lot of women killing men. I think that the and I want to back it off. It doesn't have to be fatalities. Even emotional abuse is extremely, extremely damaging. And, of course, we're creating that next generation of abuser as well. So it's all very, very serious. But it still very much is in the realm of men being the primary physical abusers.
Mm-hmm. Is the intervention the same for women as it is for men psychologically? Are there the same kind of are we dealing with the same kind of factors?
I do think that we have to back it up a bit and look at how the motivations for abuse, the driving causes, may be different for men than for women. So just to speak about that for just a moment, we already talked a little bit about why men abuse or kind of the background to that, the learned experiences, children and that sort of thing. For a lot of women that I've worked with, and I will say that in our battering intervention program here at AVDA, women make up about a tenth of our clientele. We work with around 12 to 1,300 abusers every year, and about a tenth of those are going to be in our women's program. So we don't get near as many. But we've had enough through the years that we've learned just anecdotally, what have they experienced. So a lot of those women, unlike the men, did not experience abuse in their childhood. But where did they experience it? They experienced it in relationships. So let's just say if my first three relationships are abusive and I've been the victim, well, on that fourth relationship, I may decide to turn those tables and become the aggressor because I don't want to be on the bottom of that power pyramid anymore. So women sometimes are using it as, they've learned the tools of the oppressor, if you will, and in that next relationship, they're going to be on top of that mix. Sometimes it's retaliation. Sometimes it's just simply standing up to the abuse. But it is a little bit different, and the intervention certainly can be a little bit different. I think, we look at those motivations, and I will tell you, many, many of the women that are in battering intervention programs are survivors of abuse, and some of them are even actively victims of abuse. And so it's really important that who's ever providing that service do proper screening and make sure that if you've got a woman in that group, yes, she may have assaulted her partner last month, but if she's in that program, you also need to find out, does she need to do safety planning? Because women are still primarily women oftentimes are the primary caregiver of the kids. I know we tend to do a lot more parenting with the moms. So it is a little bit different curriculum.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to a question that I asked earlier. I don't know that I got everything that I wanted to have said about it. When men or women are coming out to either get the assistance that they need or to their family about their abuse, how can they do this without putting themselves at a great deal of risk? And that's another, in my opinion, a safety concern, because family members are really not going to be thrilled to find out that you've been abusing my daughter or my son or, you know, whatever the case may be. I love it that you keep saying, having a plan. I think it's important, seeking intervention, that you have a plan. Is it okay to have in your mind, for anybody who's about to approach it, learns that they need to, absolutely knows that they should, to have the confidentiality surrounding it? Is that approach the correct approach?
I don't know if there's any particular formula that's perfect for everybody. As I shared with you the other day when we spoke, it would have created a lot more drama had I shared with my father, for example, that my husband was abusing me, because quite literally, I would not have been surprised if he would have gone with his gun and done something about that. You know, our love for our children is very, very intense, and sometimes our response to them being hurt is highly inappropriate and continues the problem on. So I do think it's important that a victim chooses who she safely or he safely confides in. But I do think it's important to confide in someone, get support, get the resources necessary to safely leave. So I'm going to stick with speaking about victims for a moment, and then we'll talk about the abuser coming out, because that's another piece of it, obviously. But we do know that the most dangerous time for a victim is when she or he is attempting to leave that relationship. The vast majority of the homicides occur either during that attempt at separation or after they've already left the relationship. So safety planning and getting your ducks in a row is so important. And as a concerned family member or friend, oftentimes I ask the question to people, if you know someone who is being abused, what would you want to tell them? And the response oftentimes is, you need to get out and you need to get out now. Well, only the victim is the expert on her abuse, and she may know that right now is not the safest time for me. There's a lot of preparation that needs to happen so I can safely leave. So I think we need to be mindful of that, because it hurts to watch somebody in an abusive relationship, but we can be there and be supportive and help them get things together so that they can safely leave. So let's talk a little bit about the abuser and the abuser coming out, because I know we had spoken about that some. I will say that the biggest challenge for an abuser in getting help is just taking responsibility for it up front. There is so much denial, minimization, blame, and that's what keeps most abusers from voluntarily getting assistance, because they simply don't see themselves as being the problem. I can't tell you how many people, it's been the norm, how many people have come through our program through the years, and they sit down in front of me and say, Sherry, I've got to tell you, I'm not like any of your other clients. You know, I shouldn't be here. It should be my wife. And then I get to look at them and say, you know, that makes you just like all my other clients, because everybody else felt the same way. So that, you know, that denial coming in the door is just, it's just classic. But that kind of leads us to the point about the criminal justice system. Most abusers, because of the dynamics and their belief system, will not voluntarily seek help. Unfortunately, I wish we've got to turn this around, but unfortunately, most wait until they're arrested for assault against a family member, and then they're ordered into a battering intervention program. And at that point, they don't typically have a lot of choice. So that's what gets most abusers into treatment, in my experience. It's not a voluntary response.
Let's say we'll paint a more perfect picture and someone does take responsibility and they say, I'm going to go into a program. How do you, tell us the steps you take to help break through that denial? I think that's very interesting.
I think it's crucial that it's a group process. In fact, in the state of Texas and in many states, the appropriate treatment for batterers and for that behavior is to go into an accredited battering intervention and prevention program. And by the guidelines that the state puts out, it's got to be a group counseling intervention. You know, it's very easy to go into individual therapy and and not deal with it, because you're just telling your truth. And their truth generally is that they've not done anything wrong and everything they've done has been provoked. So a group environment is absolutely phenomenal in dealing with this. I know at AVDA, when a man comes into a battering intervention group, he's there with maybe a dozen other men at all different stages of this 18-week program. So he may come in very angry, very resistant, and as he's talking about why he shouldn't be there, someone else across the room can reach out and say, you know, I remember what that was like on my first day too. I promise you, you're going to get something out of it, and it's going to get better. And it's really the men holding each other accountable and pulling each other through the process, asking the right questions. I mean, that is really the magic of a battering intervention program. It's not brief in duration, and even then, 18 weeks is kind of a drop in the bucket, because it takes you, you know, if I'm 45 years old, it took me 45 years to become that person. So I do think it's a lifelong process of change. But I think a reforming or rehabilitating batterer is the best person to reach out to someone who's just begun the process.
Do you find that in that process of having both the men and women in the support groups, when you are breaking through those issues of denial and whatever their belief systems have been, is it a lot of them learning to look at life in a more proper, realistic perspective, problem-solving issues, life skills? Is it a lot of that that's been maybe not in its best perspective for them?
I think certainly that's a key component to it, and having been in battering intervention as long as I have, I've seen kind of a shift in the approach. Early in the day, it was far more of a, it's always been about accountability, and it always should be about accountability. But back in the day, there was a lot more kind of shaming and blaming not going on. And I think now a more appropriate and effective intervention is to, yes, define and identify what abuse is, take responsibility for the abuse we've committed, learn about and really explore in depth what impact my behaviors have had on my family and the people I care about. And then the piece that I think we've all really honed in on and put a lot of energy into now is, what do we do instead? Because it's not, you know, we're only halfway through the equation if we talk about what not to do. So we do have to teach new skills, new belief systems, not accept what society has said was okay, because that's a big part of the problem. And so I think for us, we no longer look at our BIP participants as just being clients. We're looking at them as becoming allies in this work, and working with us out in the community side by side to change this thing around. So we want them on our team, if you will. It's not just a one-way process. Because men change men's behavior.
Mm-hmm. How successful are you seeing your results? I know that the great majority, you know, they're not knocking down doors trying to seek help. The ones that do come in, are you seeing a really great response? Are you seeing success? Are you seeing people become those allies that you are hoping to make of them?
It's definitely a difficult thing to quantify, because unless we can go home with them or we've got a video camera, you know, operating in their home, it's very difficult. And one thing I always tell my facilitators who run our groups is that you can only report on what you see for those 2 hours at a time. You know, we need to always have a healthy skepticism about the change that we believe is taking place, because if we can't validate it, you know, we certainly can't be sure. You can imagine that in all these years, I've got to believe in the process, so I couldn't continue to do it. I absolutely am convinced that programs like ours make a huge difference in people's lives. You know, AVDA, was, I'm really proud to say that ABDA was part of a CDC study, Centers for Disease Control, back, it's been over a decade ago, but there was a six-year longitudinal study that interviewed on every three-month basis a sample group of four of the largest DIPS programs in the nation, and ABDA was one of those four. And the results of that were really pretty impressive. Approximately two-thirds of the men hadn't reassaulted their partners about 15 months out. 60%
wow.
of those men, it's very, very impressive. It's exciting. Nearly 60% were still violence-free, 2.5 years afterwards. And then they also talked to the victims because, of course, you can't do this based on just self-report. They talked with the women that were associated with these men, and because they did only interview male perpetrator female victims in this, but over three-quarters of the women said that they felt very safe, that's the words they used, and many women felt that their lives had improved overall, so that's three-quarters. So, again, that's very important. We know, though, that it's time to enter into another massive study like that, and ABDA is about to launch into that again. So we're excited to see how, you know, we know that our process has changed, our curriculum, our approach has changed, and we're curious to see if the statistics and the outcomes have changed as well. But it's encouraging.
I'm excited
absolutely.
To hear that. It sure is. It sure is. And that's what this series is all about, letting people know that there is a huge amount of resources and help out there, and that the help, the assistance, the support, it's all working. It works if you really do want it to work. Let's talk about some of the specific programs that are available for assistance right where you are, and if you know of others where some listeners can reach out to nationally, you're certainly welcome to mention those. But let's talk about some of the specific things. Do most men and women start out in, what's that program called, that first intervention and the continuation of it? Are there other aspects of it that they have to continue in, become a part of?
Sure. Let's focus on what's known pretty much across the country as we refer to it as BIPP, B-I-P-P, and that stands for Battering Intervention and Prevention Program. And I think it's important to note that you don't have to be a physical abuser for this program to help you. Many people come into, especially those who are voluntary, come into the program prior to becoming physical. But they may recognize that there is emotional, maybe verbal abuse that is really just tearing apart their relationships. And so you don't have to be a physical abuser, and you certainly don't have to have been arrested to enter into a program like this. There are, I believe, over 100 battering intervention programs in Texas. I have no idea how many across the country, but every state has one. And I'd like to go ahead and put out there, I hope people at home listening have a pen handy, because I'd like to mention the National Domestic Violence Hotline, because no matter
yes.
where you live, you can find a program that will help you, whether you're an abuser or a victim of domestic violence. So that's
yes.
a 1-800 number, and it's 1-800-799-7233. So 1-800-799-7233, that's the National Domestic Violence Hotline, who I'm proud to say lives in Texas. It's actually operated out of Austin.
Yes,
and they just
yes.
I don't know the statistics, but they get thousands and thousands of calls every year. In the Houston, for those of you living in the Houston community, ABDA has the largest battering intervention and prevention program in this area, and we've got 15 different groups throughout the week, I think 11 different locations, daytime, nighttime, weekends. I mean, there really is no excuse to not get into a battering intervention program if you need one. We've got it in Spanish and in English. We have a women's group. The process is very simple for getting into that program, and that would be simply to call us. Call ABDA, that number, 713-224-9911. And let's talk about the process just a little bit. When somebody calls us, We're going to take down some basic information, and then we're going to schedule them for a one-on-one evaluation. And this really is, it's just a wonderful opportunity for somebody to come in and kind of unload what's been going on. And
right.
we don't ever want to focus on just the current relationship, because as I mentioned earlier, we're a product of our entire life. So during that evaluation, we're going to let you talk about, you know, what's been going on in this relationship, past relationships, the family that you grew up in. What are some other needs that you have? Do you have a substance abuse or alcohol issue? Do you need help with discipline, mental health? So we really will talk about all of that and try to get someone hooked up with whatever services they need to be successful. From that point, they go into an orientation session, which is a group session. And then after that, it's 18 weeks of group counseling. But I will say there's nothing magic about 18 weeks. It's just that's the state standard that Texas has. But, you know, across the country, some of the programs are 52 weeks. We recognize that everyone is an individual and have, you know, there's different needs for everybody.
Right. Tell me, you mentioned a couple of things I wanted to ask about. I had mentioned earlier about, you know, cycles of abuse and perhaps alcoholism, drugs-based factors that played a role in an abuser's history. I like that you said that, you know, we're a product of, you know, of ourselves from wherever we've come from. But you just mentioned something, that two things I want to ask about. The first is, you mentioned mental health. I hadn't really thought of that. Are you talking about a diagnosed mental health issue, or were you generically referring to just the mental health of a person in a phase of stressors? Can you speak to that?
Right. In that moment, certainly, I was talking more to diagnosed or could be diagnosed mental health issue. The same researcher who did that six-year study of ABDA has done a lot of research around mental illness and battering, because I think a lot of people in society believe that, well, you hear that word crazy, and I apologize for using that word, but he or she must be crazy to do that. Well, generally, mental health is not a primary factor, diagnosable mental illness, not a primary factor with battering. And the research that Dr. Ed Gondolf did suggested that there's the same levels of diagnoses of mental health, antisocial personality disorder, bipolar, depression, borderline. Those same things exist in the non-battering population at the same level that they do with the abuser, which I thought was very, very interesting. So we can't look at mental health as being a cause for the domestic violence. It would be very rare for that to be the case. At the same time, we need to treat whatever is going on. So if somebody, it's an encouraging statistic, I want to say. It's an encouraging fact. But also if somebody comes to us and, for example, they have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, we would not be able to put them into group counseling if they're not stable. But most mental health issues with proper treatment can be stabilized to the point that people can still get specific help for the battering intervention. So it's not problematic.
The other question. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to mention alcohol and drugs, because I think that comes up a lot. A lot of people do blame alcohol and drugs on the behavior. And what we know is that most abusers who drink and become violent also can be sober and be just as abusive. And we also know there's a lot of people out there drinking who aren't abusers at all. So alcohol really is not a causal factor, but we do know that a lot of times there is drinking that goes on during the violent episode. But I think it's a bit of a chicken and egg issue. But regardless, if somebody needs help, they need intervention to deal with that problem, we want to help them get hooked up with that as well.
My next question is similar to the mental health in a different dynamic. We talked about, I asked you about self-esteem as far as a victim, and you elaborated on that. I'm wondering about the self-esteem of a batterer. And when I ask that, I'm asking you, Have you found that there are deeper seated issues of inadequacy, or not having achieved certain things, or feelings of a lack of self-worth for various reasons? Maybe you can tell us about a typical batter, or and then maybe some other situations where we just would never think of those people as being people who would batter.
Great question. And I think it's something that we have learned through the years, and our ideas about the connection between self-esteem and batters has really changed in the last couple of decades. For years and years, early in the work, we just automatically assumed that a batter had low self-esteem. And we all know people who don't feel good about themselves, and so they pull other people down to have a sense of elevating their own self-worth. And there's no doubt that that goes on with many, many batterers. But it's been very, very interesting. A lot of the research has shown us that we've got people on that one end of the spectrum with low self-esteem. A lot of batterers have very, very high self-esteem. In fact, it's very grandiose. There are a lot of batterers out there who truly believe that their judgment is better than their partner's, so they have that gives them the justification to make decisions for the household, to preempt their decisions in parenting, financial decisions, things like that. Many of our batterers believe that they are smarter than their partner. I mean, it really is a grandiosity that has to be dealt with some of our folks. So, when you see 1,400 or so batterers a year, it's a little difficult to pick out one and say that's the norm. I think we see everything across the gambit when it comes to self-esteem. And so I think what we need to do is mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Is that also true as far as economic status?
I'm sorry, can you speak more to that? I'm not sure what you're asking.
Are you seeing that it doesn't matter what level of economic status these men and women are at, that it could be levels of poverty, it could be someone who has no financial issues whatsoever, in fact has a lot of wealth. Do you see that that's the case? It could be men and women from any walk of life?
That is so absolutely true. It's unfortunately, domestic violence is an equal opportunity societal ill. And in our program, we've worked from a trauma surgeon to a pediatrician to a police officer to a plumber to someone who's living under a bridge, unfortunately, right now. So it really is not about economic status. And in fact, those who have a lot of money may have very, very sophisticated ways to control and abuse their partner. It's not about education either. It's, as I mentioned earlier, it's not an issue of a lack of education or a lack of intelligence. It's got nothing to do with it. So we see it all the way across the spectrum. I do think that when you look at who ends up in a battering intervention program, you may tend to have folks on average with a little bit lower income than the average in society, but that may be because they didn't have the money to hire expensive defense, to fight their case. But absolutely anybody can do it. From River Oaks out into our rural areas, it happens everywhere. And I think,
yes.
But I do think since you mentioned economics, that is such an important piece of what keeps abusers caught in a relationship. Because if I'm a victim, I'm sorry, not the abuser, but the victim, if I'm a victim and I have no access to money, then I may not be able to afford a divorce. I may not be able to fight for the custody of my kids. And that may be that probably is the most important tool that an abuser can use in keeping the victim from fleeing, is saying, I will take the kids from you, you'll never see them again. And back to the self-esteem issue too, Silver Ray, for victims, if I've been told as a victim that I'm too stupid to ever hold down a job, I'm lazy, I'm no good, I'm this, I'm that, after years and years of hearing that, I may begin to believe it. And so when I'm trying to become financially independent, my belief in my ability to support myself may be really challenged. And that's what we want victims to know. There is so much help for you out there. Even the very what could be very expensive legal aspects or legal remedies are available to you. AVDA, for example, we provide free legal representation for victims of abuse. We help victims get divorces, child support, child custody. We're the second largest organization that does protective orders for victims of abuse. So there is help to jump past any obstacle a victim faces in leaving her abuser.
Well, it sounds like there is just no area that has to be out in anyone has to be left out in the dark with this, that there's a light being shed on every area of this issue and that there is plenty of help, again, for anyone who needs it. And we want to encourage you to absolutely do this. This is a huge societal ill and one that is I won't say easy. I know none of it's easy, but it's definitely doable, and it's our encouragement today to have men and women keep in mind yourselves, your own life, your families, and, again, all the other people that are impacted by this issue. You can get help. You can get loving support, and we're just wanting you to do it. And before we wrap up, Sherry, you go ahead and put your encouragement out there, and I want to thank you for so much incredible information on this topic. This was truly, truly incredible. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Silver Ray. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I think as a community, we've just got to all find our voice. It's never going to be okay to just ignore what's happening to the people that you care about or even the strangers on the street. There are ways to safely intervene. But I think as men and as women, we all need to stand up to this and say enough's enough. Let's help people get the help they need to make the changes in their lives, to be safe, and then to create that next generation that's got a much easier time of it, because there's just always help and assistance, and we want to help. So if anybody has further need for this or more information, please consider calling us at AVDA. We would love to help.
Go ahead and give out your number again and the national hotline number, please.
I appreciate that. The national hotline number is 1-800-799-7233. And the number here at AVDA is 713-224-9911. And I'd also like to give you our website. That's www.avda-tx.org.
Wonderful. Sherry, thanks again. Keep up the amazing work you're doing. You're making such a huge impact and such a huge difference. It's been a real pleasure having you as my guest today, and I hope you have a wonderful day. I'll reach out again very soon just to do some follow-up from this show. But you have a wonderful day. And if there's anything else you'd like to say before we hang up, you can do that. Otherwise, I want to bid you an amazing day and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks so very much.
All righty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And, of course, as usual, I want to thank you for being the most amazing listeners on the planet. What a wonderful conversation. I will be continuing this topic a little bit later in February. Got Master Your Mindset coming up on a week from today, but I'll also have another show this week on self-esteem. So I'd like for you to keep your eyes open to get that information as well. Again, I want to mention, if you or your family or anyone you know need some help in the area of domestic violence, please call the national hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. Again, that's 1-800-799-7233. I look forward to talking to you all again real soon. Be blessed. Have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening.